are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, August 26, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author Gary Rivlin, on his book, After the Flood. We are 10 years out from Hurricane Katrina, which struck New Orleans 10 years ago, just about. And devastated that city. And for days, we watched in really horror as the breakdown of both local, state, and federal government stranded nearly 25,000 people in the Superdome. Also on the program today, major National Labor Relations Board decision may be coming any day about the role of franchisees and franchisors. Also, the director of the CBO, appointed by the Republican Congress, a nonpartisan position, says that tax cuts don't pay for themselves. Wait, what, what? Meanwhile, Jeb, taking a page out of his brother's book, says the word evildoers. Yes, and oh, Trump, at war again with Fox, but also manages to eject the most watched anchorman in the country. Not even the most watched. I think he's more watched than all three of the networks combined, ABC or the broadcast networks, the major three, ABC, NBC, and CBS. It was amazing. The Univision anchorman, Jorge Ramos, was asking a question. I don't know. He seemed to be to asking the question before he was called on or somewhat. I don't know. But there's obviously a bit of tension between Univision and Donald Trump, not the least of which because Donald Trump has implied that Mexicans make up the bulk of rapists and whatnot. Nevertheless, Univision dropped Donald Trump's, what was it, the Miss America pageant or the Miss Galaxy, one of those pageants. Trump is now suing them for $500 million. I was actually en route to Chris Hayes' program to talk about Trump's war with Fox while he went on another a war with Univision. He kicked this guy out, but not just he kicked him out. He just nodded to a huge thug, essentially, who escorted him out. They let him back in. He answered his question, sort of implied that he would have an interview with him later. We'll play that sound later. We are shorthanded today, and Michael doesn't know how to work his computer. Oh, it's freezing. It's freezing. His computer is freezing. And
your story, though.
Yeah, my story is better. One note that I think has some relevance to sort of what we're going to talk to Gary Rivlin about in his book, After the Flood. Apparently on Joe Scarborough today, he said, this guy, nobody cares. Because Jorge Ramos is not well known. And it just, now, of course, this guy is basically like Walter Cronkite. And we don't have Walter Cronkites in the white world anymore. But he is the Walter Cronkite of the Spanish-speaking world in the United States. Or the Latino, Hispanic, I guess, world. Not necessarily Spanish-speaking. But that level of ignorance by Joe Scarborough, or just assuming that we can just say nobody knows who he is. He's really just talking about nobody in his little world knows who he is. And ultimately, that was my point on Hayes's program last night, which was, oh, yeah, this is going to hurt Trump with Latinos, without a doubt. But it's probably going to get him a couple of points in New Hampshire amongst the Republican primary voters. And that is the dilemma that the Republicans have. They are speaking to an increasingly smaller and more nationalist base, and it's going to be problematic for them. But we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk to Gary Rivlin. And I think that idea of there being sort of two major narratives coming out of New Orleans is what I'm talking about there. Whether or not New Orleans has recovered sort of depends on what perspective you're looking at it. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Ugh. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Gary Rivlin, author of multiple books, including Broke USA and Fire on the Prairie. He is a Nation Investigative Fellow, an Investigative Fellow at the Nation Institute, and a former New York Times reporter who was sent down to cover Katrina and ended up staying and covering Katrina for the Times, I believe, in 2008, and has written this book, After the Flood. Welcome to the program, Gary.
Thank you, Sam.
So, there's something about the, personally for me, I was obviously not there, but I I remember being on the radio on that first Monday night, and I don't remember the date, but I remember it was a Monday, and it becoming clear that this was going to be a major disaster, and there did not seem to be the attention that was it wasn't garnering the attention, and it seemed almost even from afar, it wasn't garnering the attention almost locally that it should have in the days leading up to it. And then, of course, there were these images and these stories for the next week or so. And you start with one of them, which was the police, or maybe it was the sheriffs, on a bridge, essentially, keeping residents of New Orleans from escaping the floods.
Right. So it was Monday, August 29th. 2005. Actually, there was plenty of advance notice. There's actually videotape of President George Bush on Sunday, the day before, hearing from the National Hurricane Center, the head of the National Hurricane Center, that this might be the worst storm of his lifetime. I mean, you could just hear the man's voice. He was scared. So there was plenty of warning. The lack of preparation wasn't for a lack of warning. But what you're talking about is the Crescent City connection, the Mississippi River Bridge, in the vernacular, some just call it the Gretna Bridge. So there's a bridge that takes you from downtown New Orleans over the Mississippi River into the suburbs, largely white suburbs. And for big parts of the city, the main way out of watery New Orleans, 80% covered with water. New Orleans was 80% covered with water. The escape route was over this bridge because on the west bank, on the other side of the Mississippi Bridge, there wasn't any water. People started walking over, largely black crowds, and the locals, the local authorities, the sheriff and the police of an 18,000 person city, got scared. And, you know, there are reports of what's going on in New Orleans, which ended up being overstated, but they were scared. And so they just took their cars, the police cars, and blocked the bridge and stood there with rifles. And you could not cross that bridge by foot. And so there's thousands, tens of thousands of people who just wanted to walk out. And they were blockaded. I mean, to me, if there had been Twitter back then, or if there wasn't so much going on, this should have been synonymous with Howard Beach in the past, with Ferguson, Missouri, with West Baltimore. You know, it was a really, really ugly incident that really gives a lie to this sense that we all are one after a disaster. They weren't all one. It was black people walking into a white community, and they were prevented from walking to safety.
What happened after that? I mean, did the sheriffs and the cops, like, you know, sort of have this moment where they realize, like, what we did was wrong? I mean, what happened afterwards?
It was the opposite. They claimed that they protected Gretna, that they protected this small town, the small town with a big heart, to use their motto, that they protected this town from getting overrun like New Orleans was run. There were lawsuits and there was ugly stuff. But, I mean, I think what's most interesting is they had no right to do what they did. It was a state-run bridge. When Kathleen Blanco, the then-governor of Louisiana, heard about it, she was furious. But, of course, it took several days because things were so chaotic and communications were so poor, there was so much to deal with, that they didn't know. Ray Nagin, the mayor at the time, he was telling the police to have people walk over the bridge to safety. That's where you go. That's where you get busted. So, you know, on the one hand, you have the governor and the mayor in New Orleans seeing the bridge as the escape route, and then you just have some town on their own and the local sheriffs just deciding to blockade this bridge and making a lot more suffering for people.
Now, I know, and I want to get to this. Your book really focuses on really, I guess, almost a decade worth of years in terms of how New Orleans rebuilds itself or doesn't rebuild itself, and particularly in those first couple of years. But just go back for us, just in terms of giving us a sense of what went wrong, because I think, you know, I think people's memories are hazy, and I think there was also just so much there was so much disinformation. There was so much of an agenda to sort of, I think, protect George Bush in some respect, because it ultimately, I think, was really, if not the defining factor in the beginning of his fall. It was certainly a major one in 2005. But I mean, what were some of the biggest failures, as you know, that became clearer in the months and the years after the hurricane struck?
I mean, to me, the blockade of the Gretna Bridge is just a metaphor for everything that would happen. Early on, there was a concerted effort among the white gentry, the uptown royals who had lived here for generations, whites, to use the opportunity of this storm to re-seize political control. The city for almost 30 years had been under a black mayor, a black city council majority, but now they saw this as their opportunity. Other factors, public housing. They called it the Big Four here, four big public housing projects. A couple of them got water. A couple of them were in pretty good shape, had minimal damage. They were never open. You know, I mean, here's a way to give affordable housing. And you can imagine, if so much of the city was flooded, there was such a premium on housing. It was so expensive. Prices increased 30-40% right away. Here was public housing, a way to bring back the kitchen workers, the housekeepers and such. It was surrounded by a fence and barbed wire and never, ever open. The governor of the state, the moderate Democrat, had before the storm wanted to close down Charity Hospital, the oldest public hospital in the country, dates back to 1736. The storm provided the opportunity. I'm staring at it right now out my window. Charity Hospital, this actually beautiful Art Deco building, has never opened. It's sitting there moldering. Now New Orleans has no public hospital. The governor wanted to seize the public schools prior to Katrina. She took over a few of the public schools after Katrina. Within 2 months, the state was running virtually every public school in New Orleans, and to this day is running pretty much every public school in New Orleans. So, you know, it provided an opportunity and at the same time neglect. One of my favorite quotes is then-Congressman Barney Frank called it ethnic cleansing through neglect. You know, a lack of policies. FEMA gave you a one-way ticket. There was never a plan to bring people home. The city had 54% renters. There was never a plan to help the renters. There was only a plan to help the homeowners.
All right, I want to come back to all this, because I want to talk about Lance Hill, and I want to talk about how many people actually exited New Orleans and then obviously never returned. But during those days, in terms of the evacuation, and in terms of, like, I mean, there were 25,000 people sent to the Superdome. I mean, I remember distinctly, and I tried to find that specific article, but I remember distinctly at the time, there was that FEMA had essentially subcontracted out the buses that would have picked people up in New Orleans, had subcontracted it out. That subcontractor had subcontracted it out. And instead of getting the buses moving early, they waited to the last possible minute because they were afraid of losing some profits on their contracts. I mean, can you tell us why so many people were stranded in the Superdome? I mean, why they had to go to the Superdome in the first place, and then why they were stranded there for so long?
So on Sunday at 9:30 a.m., the day before Katrina makes landfall, the mayor then, Ray Nagin, has the first mandatory evacuation order in New Orleans history. The problem is that, I mean, it was late. It was 20 hours before the hurricane would make landfall. But beyond that, one in four people in New Orleans don't own a car. There are some people who own a very old car and didn't have the $400 or $500, whatever it would take to get on the road, pay for gas, stay a few nights in a hotel and meals. And there was never a plan to help those without a car out of town. In fact, there's the Washington Post had a great story about the ghost train. Five Amtrak trains left New Orleans on Sunday empty. I mean, it was such an opportunity. There were buses, but they parked the buses in some place where they would drown. and the buses didn't help people get to Baton Rouge. So what the city said is, like, if you can't get out of town, go to the Superdome. They set up buses to bring people to the Superdome. They didn't set up buses to bring people out of town. And so the Superdome fills with 25,000 people, but, you know, it's a flooded city. There's all these people just walking through the water. So on Tuesday morning, the police have to break into the convention center. No one had the keys. There was no supplies there. It wasn't supposed to be used as a refuge. And, you know, by Wednesday, Thursday, there's 20,000 people there. You ask the question, why aren't there buses? To this day, I can't answer that question. You know, you point out correctly that there was the order for 1,000-plus buses, but they didn't show up. You know, it's you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the governor's screaming for buses, the mayor's screaming for buses, the governor on her own tries to find any bus she can around the state. And what happens there, Wednesday and Thursday, all these buses are coming towards New Orleans, but the drivers, because of the fear-mongering that went on among the media, all these rumors were being passed around as if it was just this reckless violence of people being murdered and raped left and right. The bus drivers were scared, and they just said, here's the bus, here's the key, you drive it, not me. And so Thursday, Friday, finally on Friday, the president showed up, and the buses showed up at the Superdome. So day five, people were there, there was no electricity, no working bathrooms, they're out of food, they're out of water. And finally, day five, the buses showed up. The buses didn't show up en masse at the convention center until Saturday, and it wasn't clear until Sunday, 7 days after. Another factor, by the way, is there's the Mississippi River right there. The convention center is virtually on the river. Bring a boat. Bring boats up to Mississippi. Ray Nagin, whose leadership I didn't quite respect, I think he was right when he said, if this was Orange County, if this was a prosperous white community devastated like this, it wouldn't have been 5, 6, or 7 days to save people. I really do think that race played a big role right there.
I mean, I have just a distinct memory of even of Shep Smith basically saying to, I can't remember who it was at the time, but on Fox, just basically saying, like, you have to stop saying this stuff because people need help here. And these claims of vigilante groups and of shootings. I mean, obviously there was some violence, but not nearly enough to keep buses from coming in there. I mean, they made it sound like it was Mad Max. And I do remember, you know, and as I was looking back on some stories from that time, from around like the 29th or the 30th, maybe the 31st, that supposedly there were ships that were supposedly en route, but no ships showed up there. And it is impossible to imagine that 20,000, you know, a white, and I imagine class also plays into this too, to a certain extent, people would be allowed to sit in a, in the Superdome without any facilities, for 5 days. I mean, there would have been helicopters coming in. There would have been something. It really was just such a disturbing time. So shortly after that, on some level, we have a story of disaster capitalism in some fashion. I mean, there was an op-ed the other day about some writer from Chicago saying we need our Katrina to essentially clean out Chicago. So talk a little bit about, you know, what at the beginning, like, you know, who dropped the ball there? I know you've written that Nagin basically seems to have been just completely overwhelmed without a clue as to what to do in terms of rebuilding.
Well, there's two different things. Who dropped the ball on the rescue? That's squarely on the White House and the Bush administration. Who dropped the ball on the rebuilding? Actually, the Bush administration had a terrible political problem. And as you pointed out, that, you know, you can argue that, you know, the Bush presidency ended here in New Orleans, you know, in August of 2005. So they actually put up a lot more money than, you know, some of the Republican allies would have had them do, because they had a political problem and they need to show that they care. Yeah, it was Ray Nagin, though. You brought up, you know, disaster capitalism. I mean, this is, you know, people talk about corruption in New Orleans, and there is corruption in New Orleans, but to me, the real corruption is that you have these big companies, the same companies that we heard in Iraq, you know, Kellogg Brown Root, that's the Halliburton subsidiary, you know, Bechtel, Fluor, Shaw, you know, it's like, here's an example. FEMA is paying $43 a cubic yard to haul debris. But by the time the sub of the sub of the sub, and there's a fifth-tier sub, to use their language, is actually doing the work, they're getting paid $7 a cubic yard. So it's like a six-fold markup. You know, the blue tarp, like any roof that was damaged by the hurricane, they would put up a blue tarp. And, you know, FEMA was paying $175 per 100 square foot. And, you know, by the time it went to the sub of the sub of the sub, they're getting paid $30 a square foot. Again, a six-time markup. And the people in the Times-Picayune, they won a Pulitzer for that. By the time, that's a local newspaper, by the time the actual worker was up on a roof doing it, they were getting about $2 per square. It's just like, it's just vulgar. It's just vulgar. Like, okay, you're doing some work, you could take a little bit of profit, but six times, you know, the profit, it was really ugly.
That's my understanding of what happened with a bunch of the buses, too. There were so many subcontractors that by the time you get down to the guy who's actually providing the buses, that and they were, I cannot remember where they were coming from, that the profit margins are so slim at that point. If they send out a half dozen buses that or 10 buses or 20 buses that aren't used, their contract is all eaten up, essentially. And so this is going on there. Why does FEMA have, why are there six subcontractors to get down to the thing? Is it just simply that FEMA was too understaffed and too sort of, because I know that one of the big things that the Bush administration did when they came in was to essentially begin to privatize a lot of FEMA services. Was there just not enough of an apparatus available to actually get to maybe not seven contractors away, but three contractors away.
I mean, it's weird. I can say, by the way, I only have a few more minutes. I have another obligation, but this is the FEMA way. You know, they go to these big contractors. They're arranging long in advance. You know, there will probably be some expensive disaster. We're going to guarantee you $100 million this year, and you're going to be our contractor to take care of that. Of course, you know, they're in whatever city they're in. And so they have to find somebody locally. They need to truck the equipment and stuff. The real problem is, why isn't it one subcontractor, maybe two? I mean, it was very typical to get down four, five, six levels, and, you know, everybody wants their piece. And by the time we're looking at it, like, you know, $1 billion worth of money is helping $100 million worth. It's really vulgar. But what I want to talk about is, like, you know, there were policies in place. I mentioned public housing. It was the Road Home program, which was designed to help the middle class and working class, but it was designed in a way that benefited white communities over black communities. So what we have in New Orleans right now, a city of 455,000 at the time of Katrina, is 100,000 less African-Americans living here in New Orleans today than at the time of Katrina. Some didn't come back because they were scared. Living in a, you know, low-lying city, some found better jobs, the kids found better school. But the real problem is that there were hurdles put in the way that made it harder for them to come back. And, you know, there was this Road Home program, which, you know, just left people short. You know, two-thirds of the homes in New Orleans are for $125,000. And yet, it costs more than that to fix it up. So they make them whole for the $125,000, whatever the home is appraised at. But it cost $200,000 to rebuild, and so many people were left shut. They did not have the money to rebuild.
Unbelievable. Let me know, when is your heart out? Do you need to go now, 5 minutes?
11:30, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It is a long-range thing at 11:30.
No problem. All right. Well, I'd love to catch up with you, because the book is fantastic. You spoke to a lot of different players in the rebuilding. You had a mole who was basically telling you what was going on, basically behind this sort of almost white curtain, if you will, of planning to rebuild the city. I'll tell the story of how the lower ninth, almost by rumor, became considered to be the lowest point in New Orleans, I should say, in terms of sea level, when in fact it wasn't the case at all.
Right. The self-fulfilling prophecy is lower ninth ward. We're going to declare this poor, low-income black community the lowest in New Orleans, even though it's not. And that's going to be the rationale for not rebuilding it, for keeping it closed longer than any other part of New Orleans. But, you know, I got to say thank you, and I need to
go. Gary Rivlin, the book is After the Flood. Thanks so much for your time today.
It's, by the way, it's Katrina After the Flood, but thank you.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Katrina After the Flood, Gary Rivlin. And there really is, I mean, it's so disturbing to think back to that time and the failure. I mean, there was a great piece by, it's completely, I mean, it makes total sense when you begin to think about it. Remember That Time by Jamel Bowie, who writes at Slate, recalling Hurricane Katrina, and it's entitled Where Black Lives Matter Began. And there was an incredible sense, and an inescapable sense, in watching this whole thing unfold, that the country just did not, and by the country I mean really the institutions and the apparatus that is supposed to deal with these type of things, did not care about these black people who were stuck in New Orleans. And you recall there was I can't remember for the life of me how much longer it was. Maybe it was a month, maybe it was weeks or 2 months. I think it was a bit of a marathon on NBC. I think it was NBC, where they were raising money for Katrina victims. And Kanye West went on, I think he was on with Mike Myers, and basically said, you know, George Bush doesn't care about black people. And I mean, I think that was true. I think that was true to a large degree, frankly. But, you know, one never knows what's in someone's heart. But what was clear is that there was a massive failure of the Republican ideology, where FEMA had been privatized to the point where they could not prepare for something like this, and they could not rebuild in an efficient way because of the enormous amount of subcontracting that had to go on. When you strip these apparatus you save in the short run. And it was sort of like what I think Bloomberg learned with the snowplows at one point. There was all sorts of privatization of the snowplows. They basically said to the sanitation department, "We're not gonna pay for as many snowplows from you, and we will just make it up on an ad hoc basis." Well, of course, when you do that, those guys who own their own snowplows are going out and doing other jobs. So if you wait, they're not going to be there. So it's either you pay to make sure that they're available in the event of an emergency, or you save a couple of bucks in the short run and risk a major disaster. And that's exactly what was done with FEMA. It was run really with the same sort of perspective that, I don't know, what was it, Independence or Freedom Industries had, where they are going to, Freedom Industries was the factory that stored the chemicals in West Virginia, I think it was. And they basically say, like, look, we can pay extra to make sure that our facility is top-notch and can never have a problem, or we can basically offload that risk onto the population in general, save ourselves the money, and if that 1 in 10, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 500,000 event happens, you know, somebody else will deal with the cost, essentially. And that's basically the attitude that FEMA was, when Michael Brown was brought in, was to basically privatize it, cut down on its services, and just, you know, when you need it, you hire the private businesses to do it. And of course, that risk is not only passed on to the public in general, but that risk is actually that much more great for those who don't have money. Right? Because that risk becomes much greater for you in New Orleans if you don't have the money to own a car. If you don't have the money to go and take a couple of days at a hotel or motel up the road because it's not going to break the bank for you, or you actually have the cash. I mean, the reality is, for some people, the idea of like, I'm going to weigh this risk. Stay here, go spend what amounts to maybe half a week's pay, maybe a day's pay, maybe a week's pay, to go stay at a motel for a couple of days. If it turns out there's no storm, there's no storm. But for a huge number of people living in that city, I can't afford to pay a month's income on the chance that this may actually happen. Or I don't even have 3 nights worth of staying at a motel. Or I don't even have the ability to get to that motel. So that risk that is offloaded by FEMA because it's been privatized, or the risk that is offloaded by Freedom Industries, or really any of these corporations that do this type of thing, it's not just offloaded to the public at large. It is exponentially more assumed, that risk, by people who have less money. So they're assuming the risk of like, well, I may end up in the Superdome with 20,000 other people and virtually no food, no plumbing, no electricity. I remember the people standing out there with signs saying, we're dying. And over 1,000 did. And so now we have this city being rebuilt. And Gary Rivlin had a mole, essentially, that it was involved in a lot of these sort of plannings, named Lance Hill. And I have the quote that gets a lot of attention from Lance Hill, which was basically like, oh, they're using this to rebuild the city as a white city, a white, wealthy city. And that's basically what they've done. And, as far as I know, and I don't know how one would even go about it, but I don't know that we have any comprehensive sense of what happened to those 100,000 people. I mean, yes, some moved to another city. They just stayed because they didn't have the money to come back. I imagine that was a lot of them. But I wonder how many of those dispossessed people, we're talking about 100,000 people, who leave with basically nothing. I think it was one of the Bushes, actually. Maybe it was Barbara Bush walking through the Houston Astrodome, looking at about 10,000 people, saying something like, oh, they're so fortunate to be getting
better off.
Better off.
Everyone is so overwhelmed by the hospitality.
And we have no sense of how people integrated into these new communities, how many children were essentially, you know, lost, just lost. They lose a year or two of school. I mean, who knows? Who knows? And I remember George Bush standing in front of, I don't know what building it was, some iconic New Orleans building. Well lit, so well lit that it looked like he was in a studio in front of a green screen. And saying, you know, I promise you, we will not abandon New Orleans. Yet 10 years later, I think they're now officially saying the recovery is over. But they're still the Ninth Ward. And I think it was at Lakeview, which was a very sort of high-end part of New Orleans, is actually below sea level. And the Ninth Ward itself, the lower Ninth Ward, no. So one of those situations which became a self-fulfilling prophecy, sort of fascinating how a rumor becomes reality, and then all of a sudden this place gets abandoned. But I encourage you all to read the book. I was trying to think if, you know, how often it is that you remember the name so vividly of a storm. And I imagine if you live in a locale that's hit by a hurricane or a tornado, you remember it. I mean, my folks still talk about a tornado that came through Worcester in 1951 or 52, I think it was. But I haven't set foot in New Orleans in 25 years, more. But that Katrina stuff still resonates with me. It's really, really unbelievable. And I think it did. I think it really did. You know, I mean, I only could imagine if we had the type of social media then that we have now as to just the sort of the level of awareness of what was going on. It would have been just horrid. And maybe, you know, these type of things, I mean, that is, maybe it would have changed the nature of the response or the nature of the rebuilding, too. Don't know. All right, folks, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. This show relies on its members for its existence. Every now and then we get an ad, but that basically just pays for Michael Chardonnay habit, or at least a portion of it.
It contributes.
It really just buys the cocktail napkins.
That's correct.
Michael likes to put down. On
well,
his
I like the there's a sort of organic line.
Yeah.
That I prefer.
Of napkins.
Right. That's right. What I'm saying. The napkins.
And so if you have the financial means to become a member, please do. You can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. You can also support the show by buying your coffee at justcoffee.coop. Free shipping. Use coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. You can buy the Majority Report blend. It's a great blend. We have it sitting right over there. Can't have ours. And you can give that as a gift. We get a little bit of something every time you buy some coffee. And it's very reasonably priced. If you buy, you know, if you buy nice coffee, this is good coffee. Fair trade. Everybody gets a fair shake at it. Good stuff. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, then you must buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Give us a review on iTunes, majority.fm/review, and pick up the app at majorityapp.com. You can IM the show with one touch. Take a quick break. We'll be right back. We'll take some phone calls, 646-257-3920. Right back after this.
Hey.